I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact.
You put a big black blob in the middle of Canada, and you reach out a tentacle to every part of the coast. There's a giant octopus that's essentially wrapping its tentacles around North America.
First Nations are saying, we understand there has to be economic development, but the way that the federal government is expanding the tar sands is just way out of control.
This week, we bring you the first of a two-part special about the frenetic exploitation of the Canadian tar sands and its rippling effects across the continent. Fighting Goliath, produced by Barbara Bernstein.
The Canadian tar sands is the largest industrial project on Earth. These deposits of a sand-embedded solid form of low-grade oil, located in the northeast corner of Alberta, cover an area the size of Florida. Everything about the extraction of tar sands is enormous. Sprawling open-pit mines, collectively the size of a large metropolitan area. Mining equipment, the height of a three-story building. Toxic tailings ponds that can be seen from outer space. But people far from Alberta are also starting to feel the effects of the tar sands' massive footprint. In the winter of 2010, people along Highway 12 in north-central Idaho first learned that their community was about to become one of the tendrils of the tar sands.
One of my board members who has a business up on US Highway 12 said that I just heard a rumor there were some giant loads that were going to be hauled through here, and can you check into this for me?
Kevin Lewis is the conservation director for Idaho Rivers United, based in Boise, Idaho, 200 miles south of Highway 12.
I got in touch with local residents. They had, in fact, just recently suffered a power outage.
One of the linemen told me that they were raising all the power lines along US 12 because an oil company was going to be bringing big loads through.
Linwood Lahey is a resident and activist in the Clearwater Valley of north central Idaho.
So I drove into Lewiston and went to the Idaho Transportation Department, and they said yes, this was going to happen.
The Imperial Oil modules were headed from South Korea, where they had been built, to the tar sands of Alberta, Canada.
Borg Hendrickson lives with her husband, Lynn Lahey, in the wild and scenic Clearwater Corridor.
We had never heard of the tar sands before. We have since learned a lot about the tar sands.
Attempts to exploit tar sands deposits along the Athabasca River in northeastern Alberta date back decades. But the process of turning the tar-like bitumen contained in the tar sands into a useful product is extremely expensive and energy-intensive. So there was no financial incentive to expand tar sands production as long as the price of oil remained low.
In the late 1990s, as the price of oil started to rise, and it was becoming obvious to a lot of people that the era of light, cheap oil was coming to a close, there was a gold rush. And every major oil company on the planet secured a lease, our mining operation.
Andrew Nikiforuk is a writer and journalist living in Calgary and author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent.
Canada was producing maybe 500,000 barrels of bitumen a year. By 2005, we were up to 1 million barrels.
Our forecast sees that going from about 2 million barrels a day today.
Greg Stringham with the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers.
To just close to 5 million barrels a day by the year 2035.
The vast deposits of bitumen in the Canadian oil sands were originally light, sweet crude oil.
Bob Skinner, interim director of the Canada School of Energy and the Environment in Calgary.
But it has degraded by bacteria, chewing away at the hydrogen atoms, and oxidation by water.
Bitumen really just is a fancy word that means oil that won't flow to a well by itself.
The challenge with bitumen making it into a useful product is that we have to reverse all those geological and natural processes and geological time over millions of years. And of course, we're going to concentrate that in, geologically speaking, a nanosecond. And that takes energy and it takes resources, takes water, manpower.
The boreal forest under which these bitumen deposits rest are the continent's northern lungs. They sequester enormous amounts of carbon and they breathe enormous amounts of oxygen. The muskeg, which is the swampy parts, hold these incredible peat bogs that have sequestered carbon for nearly 10,000 years. When you come along with a mining operation and you start draining these swamps and then digging them up, you're digging up 10,000 years of work by Mother Nature.
They take oil sands out with very large trucks and shovels, then drive across the mine to a central processing facility. They add water, and then they can put that slurry of sand and oil and water into a pipeline that moves it up to the separation facilities. The oil is scraped off the top, and it's then moved through an upgrader to change it from heavy oil into light oil.
These open pit mines are among the largest open pit mines in the world, and they're all located on either side of the Athabasca River. You have all this clay and hydrocarbon deposits and heavy metals that is deposited in tailings ponds, these huge lakes that are raised above the landscape about 100 meters high. We really don't know, once we've destroyed this forest, how to put it back together in any sense that would resemble the wonderful natural capital that was once there.
The current tar sands boom in Alberta is part of a Western tradition of boom and bust economies. In Idaho and Montana, frenetic resource extraction goes back to the 19th century.
Montana, for a long time, was basically owned by Anaconda corporate interests. People literally with money bags going to the state capital in Helena and passing out the goods.
Onyx Smith is a writer and filmmaker living in Montana's Blackfoot Valley.
Anaconda started mining copper in Butte, late 19th century. First it was underground mines, and eventually most of the city collapsed into the pit, and then they did strip mining until they could get cheaper copper in Chile.
After the Anaconda Company began to lose some of its power, the Montana Environmental Policy Act was the first act of a rebellious people.
Bob Gentry is an attorney in Missoula, Montana.
And in 1972, Montana rewrote Montana's constitution to include fundamental right of all Montanans to a clean and healthful environment.
Since then, of course, we've been going slowly, slowly, slowly back to the old corporate mining, get what you can and get out philosophy. Now we've got the fracking going on in eastern Montana. Again, as soon as the gas runs out and the oil runs out, that's going to be ghost country again.
Like Montana, much of Idaho's history has been dominated by exploitation of the state's vast timber and mineral riches. So in 2010, it was no surprise that state officials welcomed Imperial Oil's proposal to haul shipments of gigantic mining equipment across the state.
Imperial Oil had proposed bringing 207 loads.
Clearwater Corridor resident Lynn Lahey.
They were 29 feet 11 inches high and two-thirds the length of a football field.
Some of the megaloads are as much as 28 feet wide.
Kevin Lewis, Idaho Rivers United.
So on like Highway 12, which is just a two-lane winding mountain road, the really wide loads overhang the entire highway and the shoulders of the highway.
Sections of the Clearwater-Locksaw Corridor were not even paved until the 1970s. There's a better than 100-mile stretch without any gas stations, restaurants, or human services of any kind.
Stephen Hawley is a writer from Hood River, Oregon.
It's by designation that these areas have stayed wild and scenic. And the mistake that Imperial Oil made was just assuming that those laws didn't mean anything to people.
This is my road. I've lived on it for 20 years.
Montana writer David James Duncan, reading from his essay, The Heart of the Monster.
Big Oil is asking its drivers to drag 650,000-pound loads over highways rated for 80,000, over bridges made of aged creosoted timbers, and over aged concrete and steel. The rigs will be crossing underground sewers, gas lines, power lines, water mains. When damage occurs, it will be unseen till the loads are long gone, so locals will suffer the consequences and pay for the repairs.
In the summer of 2010, Idaho Department of Transportation and Imperial Oil said, hey, this is what we're doing, it's a done deal.
The public resistance started rising and they began to realize that they really needed to have some public meetings.
I got a phone call from this woman from Missoula who said, there's a meeting in Kuski, Idaho, and your name came up as a writer who might want to come to this meeting. I get there and it's a packed house. Imperial Oil representatives were clearly not expecting this many people to be at the Kuski Town Hall.
It had been billed as a meeting. People were angry because they said, when does the meeting start? And they'd say, well, we're not having one. I went to an ITD employee that I'd been dealing with, and they said, people are starting to leave, and so I think you should have a meeting because otherwise people are going to go away angry. And he said, no, Linwood, we're not having a meeting.
And the next excuse was, well, we don't have a public address system. And then Lynn said, I have one. I'll set it up now. The half dozen Imperial Oil representatives proceeded to sit and listen for the next 2 hours about what folks in Kuski thought about this idea of turning their river corridor into an industrial corridor.
When asked how Imperial Oil would deal with a tip-over and dumping of a module into the Locksaw River, Imperial spokesman Dan Johnson told the public, we could have a crane up here from Spokane in 10 hours.
David James Duncan from The Heart of the Monster.
What Johnson failed to mention is that no crane of this size is available in Spokane, that a 500-ton crane is an even more problematic transportation problem than the module it would set out to retrieve, and that a crane can only tilt 20 degrees from vertical, so it couldn't reach out over the rivers to retrieve the module anyway.
After the Kuski meeting, the grassroots network Lynn and Borg had started, rural people of Highway 12 Fighting Goliath continued to grow.
Our website, fightinggoliath.org, was intended not as much to inspire resistance as to provide information, because we were convinced that the information was overwhelmingly convincing all by itself.
Meanwhile, Idaho Rivers United, along with the Nez Perce tribe, through whose land the giant trucks would travel, petitioned the Forest Service to block the megaloads from entering the Clearwater National Forest. The Forest Service claimed they had no authority to block the megaloads, spurring the two groups to sue the Forest Service and the Federal Highway Administration in federal court for failing to protect the wild and scenic river corridor. Word of the megaloads spread to Missoula, Montana in early 2010.
This was an invitation from the oil producers in Canada to become involved in the tar sands issue.
Zach Porter is a Missoula environmental activist.
Because for all the times that they call us meddlers from the United States, when they bring their project right through our main streets, it's our issue.
Soon after Zach heard about the megaloads, the Montana Department of Transportation held a public meeting in Missoula to inform the community about the plan to move the enormous loads through Montana. More than 250 people showed up to learn that the project was pretty much a done deal.
Representatives from Imperial Oil were sitting in the middle of one of the local elementary school basketball courts. Meanwhile, public officials from the Montana Transportation Department, the people who really should have been answering to the public, were hiding off in a corner somewhere.
I was really incensed about the way that they just disregarded everybody's comments at this meeting.
Steve Senninger is an economist at the University of Montana.
Whether it was about the economics, about the environment, about travel problems.
What just didn't make any sense was why they would have settled on this route. By digging with the help of attorney Bob Gentry, we learned this route was chosen because it was the only way to get these modules from the West Coast to the tar sands without going under an overpass.
It became apparent to me that this route was not selected by Montana Department of Transportation, but was instead selected by contractors of Imperial Oil.
After the Missoula meeting, Zach Porter got involved with a group called the No Shipments Network. At weekly meetings, they planned strategies to stop the megaloads. Their first action was a demonstration on Reserve Street, a major artery that the megaloads would travel on their way through Missoula. Meanwhile, Susan Estep, who is connected with the Women's Donor Network, pulled together people with financial and professional connections. She held a meeting at her house where she met Spider McKnight, a longtime activist and communications specialist. Susie immediately recruited Spider to do messaging and publicity for the incipient campaign.
I saw in the paper they were having a demonstration on Reserve Street, and I went there and I was like, okay, I'm going to find an organizer here. And I was watching the crowd, and then there was this really articulate young man with a bullhorn, and I was like, that's our guy. And it turned out to be Zach Porter.
We began to work with some attorneys.
Susan Estep, co-founder of All Against the Hall.
We connected with the folks in Idaho who were doing work there, and of course, they were ahead of us by many, many, many months.
Attorneys working with All Against the Hall recruited and trained community members to submit comments during the public comments period that opened after the environmental assessment was published. Among those testifying at the hearings was economist Steve Senninger, who countered the argument that the project would create much-needed jobs for the region.
These are rural areas where unemployment is high. When these projects come along and they dangle the promise of employment in front of folks, local county commissioners, out-of-work people react to that and say, well, here's something that's going to save us.
There are no jobs from these projects. These are outside companies. They bring their workers and their equipment. Yeah, they'll stay in a motel room a few times or buy a pack of cigarettes at the smoke shop.
Kevin Lewis, Idaho Rivers United.
A huge component of the economy of that river canyon is the river canyon itself and the tourism that it brings. And that's the sort of thing that you will run off with moving megaloads to the river corridor.
We created a coalition, All Against the Hall, and it was all about the all.
We said, we're not going to start this by going out and telling people what this is about. We're going to go and ask people what they think it's about.
We met with ranchers, we met with farmers, we met with the Square Dance Center along the highway.
This annoyed people who were the most ardent right-wing property rights activists, as well as people on the far left who were up in arms about the Canadian tar sands. Our job was to bring them all together.
I thought it was a wonderfully ironic moment when this rancher was talking about how these people, they just think they can come over and go through our land and take what they want and do what they want and make it their own. And I remember the native man I was next to looking over at him, and we both sort of chuckled, and then the rancher looked at him, and there was this profound moment of understanding right there.
I heard about it from Susie Estep, who is a friend of mine.
Onyx Smith is one of a number of well-known writers who have made Montana their home. Montana's natural history is the backdrop for much of what they write about, and over the years, many of these writers have taken stands to protect the values that attracted them to Montana.
Susie Estep had the sense to know us and to say, okay, we can use these people. They're not the best organizers in the world. They don't have a lot of money, but they can write.
Onyx wrote an open letter to Governor Brian Schweitzer, published in newspapers throughout Montana in October 2010.
Dear Governor Brian Schweitzer, I remember the stirring speech you gave at the Democratic National Convention in 2008.
We face a great new challenge, a world energy crisis that threatens our economy, our security, our climate, and our very way of life. We need to break America's addiction to foreign oil. We need a new energy system that is clean and green and American-made.
That day, I was proud of my governor for being on the side of the future. Now, I'm not so proud. These days, you say, we need energy and the safest supply right now is coming from places like Alberta, meaning the dirtiest type of fossil fuel extracted from the tar sands. And then you say, this is conflict-free oil. I'm afraid, Governor, that Alberta's tar sands oil is in no way conflict-free. Putting aside big-time environmental objections, let's focus on conflicts in Montana. The equipment necessary to mine and extract tar sands oil is gigantic. It is manufactured in Asia. Super trucks are needed to haul super machines, and the shortest, cheapest way to haul them from South Korea to Alberta is across the Pacific, up the Columbia and Snake Rivers, then overland through Idaho and Montana. We will be the sacrifice zone for super profits for multinational corporations. Their plans, which your administration seems to be backing, would transform Highway 12, a national scenic byway along the Clearwater and Lockaw Rivers, and Highway 200 along the world-famous river that runs through it, into a permanent industrial corridor. Every night for who knows how many months, giant mechanical beasts will traverse our countryside and pass through towns. They will delay emergency services and local traffic, depress property values, destroy historic and archaeological sites, and harm tourism and recreational businesses that are the lifeblood of our communities. But we don't have to be a colonial state. Please, Governor, return to your call for green energy and help the concerned citizens of Montana stop the big rigs from running over us.
Because my good friend David James Duncan lives on Highway 12, I called him up and said, David, you have to help us. He said, don't talk to me. I can't do this. I'm writing a novel. I said, David, you have to do it. This is your road. This is your river.
Susie Estep persuaded David, who then recruited fellow Montana writer Rick Bass, to co-author a rapid response book about the megaloads.
The rigs were coming in 2 months. As crazy as it was, we had to try to produce a book in 2 months. We knew that any book publisher we approached would tell us we were absolutely out of our minds. So our publisher became All Against the Hall.
Oregon writer Stephen Hawley traveled the megalode route with David and Rick and researched the book's source material.
We named the book The Heart of the Monster, based on a Nez Perce creation legend.
The Nez Perce creation myth centers around a unique rock formation along the route of the megalodes.
That is supposedly the heart of a great monster that once consumed every creature on Earth. The last creature left outside the monster was Coyote. Coyote allowed himself to be eaten by the monster, and when he got inside, he started a fire that cooked the monster's heart and then cut the heart loose. The monster's heart fell on the ground, and that is that pile of basalt rubble right by Highway 12 in Idaho. The Nez Perce people were created when they climbed out of that rubble.
These trucks were sort of a modern-day monster that had to be stopped. And we liked that metaphor well enough that we asked the Nez Perce if we could use it for the title of the book, and they said yes.
The book became the cornerstone of the campaign, finding its way onto the desks of Governor Brian Schweitzer, Montana Senator John Tester, and other political leaders, and into the hands of activists and donors across the country. David Duncan painted a vivid picture of the scale and scope of the ecological disaster that the gigantic trucks would help create.
The tar sands of Alberta are displacing one of the last great planetary preserves of avian fecundity with a second Gulf of Mexico-like disaster to the north. On April 8, 2008, the bodies of 1,606 dead waterfowl were scooped from a Syncrude tailings pond. Syncrude's effluent pond is formed by the second largest dam on Earth. The massive sludge reservoir this dam encloses is poison central. The reservoir is located amid the ancient nesting grounds of millions of waterfowl and other birds. During a blinding early morning snowstorm, the birds were forced to rely on migratory memory and landed on the Death Lake. The industry's idea of a warning system? When a flock of waterfowl flies close to the biggest reservoirs, a cannon might fire. On the morning of the 1,606 duck kill, the cannon didn't fire because it was snowing. A Syncrude spokesperson later acknowledges on film that the actual number of birds killed that morning or any morning is impossible to determine because mired birds sink fast in the sludge.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of support from listeners like you, this show was distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to Fighting Goliath, produced by Barbara Bernstein.
The proposed heavy haul corridor through Idaho and Montana is just one of the tendrils of the tar sands that include inputs and outputs stretching across Canada, through the heartland of the United States, down the Pacific coast, and across the Northern Rockies and Pacific Northwest.
ExxonMobil had identified Highway 12 as the route to the tar sands, and the word spread among big oil companies that, hey, Exxon's got this road getting ready for us.
Borg Hendrickson, Fighting Goliath.
There was no question that they intended for this to become a permanent industrialized route to the tar sands.
Before Imperial ExxonMobil had secured the needed permits to haul its 200 megaloads through Idaho and Montana, ConocoPhillips received permission to haul a single megaload headed to a mine in Billings, Montana, along part of the same route. Lynn Lahey and Borg Hendrickson organized residents along the route to monitor the load from Lewiston into Montana.
Our full intention was simply to be a car on the road. We were not protesting, we were not obstructing, we were not getting arrested, but it wasn't long before we realized these aren't our state police. The state police are working for a Canadian oil company.
They would pull over monitors and tell them if they came through the load again, they would be pulled over and arrested.
They went through and put no parking signs and cones on every turnout on Highway 12 for over 100 miles.
So the megaloads blocked access to all the beaches, trails, and campgrounds along the river and created a rolling roadblock that stopped emergency responders and people on their way to the hospital. After much delay and hassle, the trucks made it over Lolo Pass, the border between Idaho and Montana, and drove into Missoula.
The trucks came through in the middle of the night.
Spider McKnight, all against the haul.
There was a protest and we all went out. It was pitch black. And then out of the darkness came these blinding lights. And you didn't know what was behind them. All you could see was light coming at you. And from really high up, as it got closer, you saw these round shadows behind these big lights. It felt like an invasion.
Jim Lynch, head of the Montana Department of Transportation, was pushing to expedite the permitting process for the megaload project. Meanwhile, attorney Bob Gentry was busily following the paper trail.
One of the things that attracted my attention were presentations that Director Jim Lynch had made in the summer of 2009.
We are actually setting the stage for a high, wide corridor through the state of Montana to be used probably for things that we haven't even imagined yet. We're talking about 200 to 500 loads, and that is a significant impact to the state.
By April, the Department of Transportation had published an environmental assessment that said there were no significant impacts.
There are impacts. We don't feel that they're significant. So we're fairly confident they'll be able to demonstrate to the department that the environmental impact is minor, and they may have a very small environmental assessment to prepare for us before we can issue a permit.
So something changed between July of 2009 and September of 2009 to put this project on the fast track.
The Montana Department of Transportation released their finding, which concluded that ExxonMobil's megaload project would have no significant impacts and could go ahead as proposed. Lawyers with All Against the Haul believed that this decision violated the Montana Environmental Policy Act. Once the finding was signed, the Montana Sierra Club, Montana Environmental Information Center, and the National Wildlife Federation filed a lawsuit against the MDT. Their case was greatly strengthened when a critical partner stepped up.
The Missoula County Commissioners came forward saying, we oppose this project and we are interested in doing whatever it takes to make sure that the law is followed, because this could have very significant impacts to Missoula County residents.
People know about the trucks and they know that there's this lawsuit going on, and all of a sudden the Yellowstone pipeline burst. Oil coming from Canada started polluting the Yellowstone River, and people had to evacuate their homes, and there was major cleanup, and we lost fish and birds.
This morning, Montana's governor says ExxonMobil is just guessing at the amount of damage from the spill and is downplaying the environmental effect. ExxonMobil disagrees, saying pollution is limited mostly to a 10-mile area near Billings.
In the end, Governor Brian Schweitzer came to oppose the project.
Zach Porter, executive director of All Against the Hall.
I think he realized that it was a bigger political liability than it was worth.
I don't think that we would have seen capitulation from Brian Schweitzer if we had not had the Yellowstone River spill.
Susie Eastep, All Against the Hall.
Exxon was very slow to respond. They were extremely difficult to work with, and I think Brian Schweitzer got mad and realized that this was not a good game to play.
Imperial Oil wanted to ship through the corridor what they called the test validation module, one large load, to prove that they could do it.
Kevin Lewis, Idaho Rivers United.
And things didn't go as smoothly as they thought they would go. They ended up snagging a guy wire to a power pole and disrupting the power to over 1,000 residents. Then it was parked for 2 weeks while they went along and trimmed more trees through the Wild and Scenic River corridor.
It came to light that Imperial Oil was doing something it said it couldn't do.
Attorney Bob Gentry.
At the Port of Lewiston, it was cutting these modules in half, making them short enough that they could go under overpasses and bridges along the interstate system.
Because the Montana Department of Transportation had misled the court by claiming there was no way to cut down the loads and ship them by a different route, the judge ruled against the MDT and placed an injunction against any further megaload shipments through rural roads in Montana.
The judge in Montana allowed this test validation module into Montana only as far as the first private place they could park it.
So it was stuck up at Lolo Pass for quite a while and became kind of a tourist attraction. People would go and be like, here's the stuck truck, and it's never going to go through.
In June 2012, Imperial Oil withdrew its megaload permit applications, saying they had finished transporting all their modules to northern Alberta by freeway. But as it turned out, at quite a cost.
Imperial Oil said that they were over budget by $2 billion and behind schedule.
Each one of those modules that they had to change cost them an additional $500,000.
Writer Stephen Hawley.
Each day that they didn't have this equipment there to start refining bitumen in Alberta was also costing them money.
I wish I could say that this was about stopping the tar sands. It was about stopping the trucks.
Spider McKnight, All Against the Hall.
We knew that there's a lot of ways that can get to the tar sands, and if we stop it, they'll probably just go to another community. But we wanted to find ways to make a model of how other communities could fight it, because we see each little arm as a tendril in the octopus. We'll just cut off one arm at a time.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Tune in next week for part two of Fighting Goliath, written, narrated, and produced by Barbara Bernstein, and a production of The Media Project and Feather and Fin Productions. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get our podcast, download shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Original music was composed and performed by Barbara Bernstein, Bob Bernstein, Clark Salisbury, and Aaron Andrade. This program was made possible with funding from the Regional Arts and Culture Council, the Fund for Investigative Journalism, and Oregon Humanities, an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.